Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. And coming up, a provocative new book that says the U.S. economy wouldn't have grown into the giant that it is without slavery. We'll talk with the author, Edward Baptist.
But first, let's get to that huge and deadly snowstorm blanketing upstate New York. At least 6 people have died, and some areas around Buffalo are buried under 6 feet of snow. Let's get the latest from Erie County Chief Executive Mark Poloncarz, who's on the line from Cheektowaga, New York. Mark, welcome.
My pleasure, Peter.
And just look out the window for me. What are you seeing?
Well, right now at the Emergency Operations Center in the town of Cheektowaga, it is actually sunny. This is an area that got hit exceptionally hard during the storm. We have a respite right now as the snow band has moved north and will be like that through the remainder of this day. But we do unfortunately expect it to move back south into the area that was significantly impacted. So we're getting an opportunity to get out there, do reconnaissance and clean up before we get hit again.
Yeah, and this was just a monster storm and a fatal one. We're hearing about people being stranded at toll booths, people stuck in their cars for, you know, up to 20 hours or more. Are crews having trouble getting those people to safety?
Well, we believe every one of those individuals that was stuck at the New York State Thruway or the major state routes of the 400 and 219 have now since been taken out of their vehicles and are taken to shelters. But yes, unfortunately, many people were stuck in their vehicles. We advised folks due to the severity of the storm and the efforts that we were doing to avoid driving into the snowbound area. Unfortunately, people did. And once they did, they got stuck. We have literally hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of vehicles that are abandoned on major arterial roads throughout Erie County. This storm was like a knife that cut through the heart of the county. The snow band itself was only about 10 miles wide, but it hit one of the most heavily populated areas, and approximately 450,000 to 500,000 people were affected by the storm.
And can you explain this? You have something that you know very well, the lake effect, where, you know, you may have a lot of snow in one place, but almost none in another.
Correct. The lake effect snow bands are generated by the wind direction of the wind coming across Lake Erie. The irony of the storm is if you were just above the snow band, you got nothing. Downtown Buffalo, you may have seen some of the pictures from downtown skyscrapers. Downtown Buffalo got almost nothing. And the area just literally maybe 600 yards south of it ended up with 3 to 5 feet. So what happened is we normally can handle snow. We can handle 2 feet of snow in a day. But some of these areas received up to 6 feet of snow in basically a 24-hour period, which is unheard of out here. So we're finally getting to the point now where we're starting to open up major arterials, and we're hoping we can get to some of the secondary streets, but most of the side streets and the residential streets we will not be able to get to for a number of days.
And we're hearing that Governor Cuomo deployed 150 members of the National Guard. What are they doing?
I requested the governor to do the deployment early yesterday morning. He did do that. They've come with Humvees. They're assisting with not only traffic control, they're assisting with the cleanup. There was a number of nursing homes that unfortunately their staff had been working around the clock for almost 2 days, and they could not get replacement staff in. So we have the National Guard with the Humvees picking up replacement staff and taking home staff at these nursing home and these other hospital facilities.
Yeah. Talk about more of the dangers that you face when you see this much snow. There's cars abandoned on the highways. People have heart attacks when they're shoveling this amount of snow. What are the dangers?
Well, we've had a number of things that we've had to worry about. We're not just talking about snow. The temperatures dipped to the lower teens with wind chills that were right around zero. It was life-threatening situations, and unfortunately, it did take some lives. We're also advising our residents in the snowbound area that if they have high-efficiency gas furnaces, they need to go out because they have lower flue systems that are only 3 or 4 feet off the ground. Normally that's not a problem, but if you've got 5 feet of snow up against it, it could be blocking your flue from working properly and carbon monoxide coming back into the homes. We did have some reports of that. And of course, we've also had some people lose power. So we've had people use generators, and we're advising them they must not use a generator indoors. If you use a generator indoors, you in all likelihood are risking death. So there's some significant things that can happen in a snowstorm. We're used to dealing with storms. Unfortunately, this storm was such that it's just delivering such a wallop.
Right. And back in 1977, people who were in Buffalo at that time remember another terrible blizzard. 2 dozen people in the region died that time around. How does this one compare to that?
Well, I was alive back then. I was a young lad. I was 9 years old. I do remember it. It was a very, very devastating storm. The snow totals were actually less than what we had here, but the conditions were worse for a prolonged period. So more people, unfortunately, died in their vehicles. The advantage we have today that we did not have back in 1977 is people have cell phones, so if they do end up getting stuck, they can call our 911 system and we can identify where they are. Back in 77, if someone got stuck, there was really no way to find out about that unless somebody stumbled upon the vehicle. So the advantages of modern technology have helped us, but during the worst part of the storm, it was very treacherous, and the only way to be able to traverse some of these roads was by foot. Even snowmobiles, because there was so much snow, couldn't get through because the snowmobiles were actually digging into the snow and basically being submerged.
Wow. Mark Poloncarz, chief executive of Erie County, New York. The area has just been dumped on, more than 5 feet of snow, more on the way. Mark, good luck to you.
Thanks, Peter.
And some incredible photos of that storm with the hashtag Snowvember on Twitter. Well, a new report out this week says 36 million people are living in modern-day slavery across the globe. The Australia-based group Walk Free released the second edition of its Global Slavery Index, which surveyed 167 countries and found that 60,000 slaves are living right here in the U.S., which, as we know, has its own painful history with slavery, a history that Edward Baptist says we don't often acknowledge as a major driver of the country's early economic growth. His new book is The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Edward Baptist is with us from Atlanta. Welcome.
It's great to be here, and thanks for having me.
And when you say the half has never been told, what you're talking about is an acknowledgement that without slavery, America's economy never would have grown into the global dominant economy that it is.
Yeah, I think that's one way to view the half. The other is to understand that a lot of that critique, that understanding of history was always there, in particular in the memories of formerly enslaved people.
So why do you think that that half has not been told?
Well, I think that by and large, the United States and more broadly Western societies have not wanted to hear that story over the last couple of centuries. We've lived through this period of increasing prosperity by and large, where we've had the fundamental transformation of our economies in a way that the world has never seen. And of course, there have been ups and downs, the Civil War, World War II, World War I. Communism, et cetera. But over the course of that time, our world has been transformed by this sort of economic growth. And we don't want to hear that at its root, the economic growth depends to a large extent on slavery.
Well, make your case for us. Explain how important slavery was for the growth of the early American economy.
Well, both for the American economy and for the British economy, it's important to understand that the massive transformations that they go through in the 19th century, they shift from being primarily agricultural to primarily industrial in terms of how they make their wealth, how they generate their income. These processes happen first and foremost in cotton textile factories. And in order to have cotton textile factories, which are the first factories of the industrial system, and they change the way that people wear clothes all around the world, the way they buy clothes, the way that trade happens, the way that people work as they're now working in these factories instead of in the fields. None of that is possible without having cheap cotton. And cheap cotton, above all, is delivered to those factories by enslaved people in the expanding American South. In fact, they can deliver cotton so cheaply and to such a massive extent that they essentially put all other cotton producers out of business by the 1830s.
And you write in the book, cotton became the dominant driver of U.S. economic growth in 1802. Cotton already accounted for 14% of the value of all U.S. exports, but by 1820, it accounted for 42%.
Yeah, and that just continues to grow. In fact, from 1820 to 1860, over that long period of time, over half of all the money that's earned by U.S. products overseas comes from one single product, and that's cotton. You know, cotton plays a role that's kind of analogous in the world economy of the 19th century to what you see petroleum and petroleum products playing in our world today.
And you look at some of the detail that you bring up in this book, and particularly you're talking about New Orleans as the pivot of economic expansion. And you describe a New Orleans that looks very different from the New Orleans we see today, with just ship after ship after ship lined up there in New Orleans, ready to take export of all of this cotton.
That's right. That's right. It's the leading cotton port in the world. And it's also, by some measures in the 1830s, the most important financial center in the United States. There's capital coming in. There's capital coming out. And eventually it'll lose that fight. And New York, of course, will become the financial center. But there's a moment where it looks like it can be. And there's one other thing that it's a crucial center for, and that's for the domestic slave trade. And that's the process of moving almost a million enslaved African Americans from the older states, where the chance for profits from field labor are not as good, but the chance for profits from selling people to the domestic slave traders are very good. So they get moved from those old states and are transported to the new states, where cotton planters in particular are ready to pay extremely high amounts of money in order to buy typically 16 to 25-year-olds, men and women.
And we know from history that there were people in this country who thought that slavery was abhorrent and thought that it should go away. But it looks, from what you're writing, that all along the way, those who really had the power of the federal government decided to allow it to happen because they knew how important it was to the economy of the U.S.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's a sense among some American policymakers around the time of the Constitution that slavery is doomed as an institution. We have to bargain with slaveholders right now, who, after all, controlled a lot of the wealth of the country. But over time, as we can see, their profitability is decreasing. The planters of tobacco and rice and so on in particular are in hard times in the 1780s. As we see their profitability is decreasing, we can let slavery, in effect, die out on its own, especially if we close the slave trade from Africa. But because there was such a large population of enslaved people already, and because a new source of profit, the growing of cotton and the shipping of cotton to the new factory system, because that came up, it turned out that that calculation was completely wrong, in fact.
We're talking with Edward Baptist, author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, a provocative argument there. And you can weigh in at hereandnow.org. Would the U.S. economy be what it is now without slavery? This is Here and Now, and if you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Edward Baptist. He's the author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. And Edward Baptist, we think of the people who were profiting from the slave trade as being in the South, at least the slave owners are having more direct tie to slavery. But in fact, you write, historians have been ignoring that investors from the North and from abroad benefited from slave labor cotton in the South. How did they benefit?
Yeah, I think this is something that historians are actually now starting to really catch hold of and run with. But it's a remarkable story. There, for instance, is a huge firm of slave traders, one of the biggest businesses in the United States by any measure in the years 1830 to 1832 or so. Isaac Franklin of Tennessee, John Armfield of Virginia, and Rice Ballard of Mississippi and Virginia. And these three individuals mastermind the moving of about 5,000 enslaved human beings a year from the older states to the new states. Now, this necessitates a huge amount of money and a huge amount of credit. And that means they have to have great relationships with banks. And they have great relationships with banks in Richmond and in Mississippi, and above all with the Bank of the United States, which is an officially chartered bank, the main depositor of the United States government at that time. It also serves as sort of the Federal Reserve, as a regulator of the economy. And, oh, yeah, they're constantly lending money and getting paid back by these slave traders.
Would the slave trade have been able to grow to the size that it did without that amount of credit coming from these banks?
Probably not. Probably not. That certainly makes the operations much more efficient. It makes slave buyers in places like Maryland or Virginia, it makes it much easier for them to pay a sort of uniform or standard predictable price. And then on the other hand, those close links to the banks in places like Mississippi enable them to help buyers line up loans from local banks and so on and so forth. Credit is crucial to the process.
And you use the word efficient there. The other thing that was crucial to the process, you write, is these slave owners being just absolutely awful to the slaves to try to get them to produce more stuff and more quickly.
Yeah. When you look at the history of the Industrial Revolution and the factory system, one of the things that's remarkable and one of the things that is at the bottom of how it makes a difference in our lives is the fact that the shift to organized, rationalized, machine-based production over time means that for a given amount of labor, 8-hour day, a 12-hour work day by a worker, the product that comes out is greater. And this is absolutely crucial, continues to this day. But at the same time, we don't think that that kind of productivity increase is possible in hand labor, or we sometimes don't think that. But it turns out that, in fact, in the production of cotton in the fields of the southern United States, enslaved people year after year produce cotton more and more efficiently. The average enslaved person picks 2% per day faster every single year from 1800 to 1860. And that means that by 1860, the average cotton picker is four times as efficient as they were in 1800. And this helps to explain how these different link processes of increasing productivity, increasing efficiency work together to create this much bigger dramatic economic change.
One of the ways that you did the research for this book was to listen to interviews that had been done with former slaves. And we have a little bit of tape from one of them. Let's take a listen.
If I thought that I'd ever be a slave again, I'd take a gun and just end it all right away. Because you're nothing but a dog. You're not a thing but a dog. If they want you to cut all night long out in the field, you cut. And if they want you to hang all night long, you hang. Hang tobacco. It didn't matter about your tired being tired. You're afraid to say you're tired.
Tell us more about these tapes and how you got them and what's in them.
The tapes were part of a larger project, which is something that takes place mostly in the 1930s. This is going out and interviewing surviving ex-slaves. And most of these were done by the Works Progress Administration, part of the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. The New Deal was trying to put people to work, so they would take grad students whose programs had shut down, school teachers had been laid off, and things like that, send them out there to interview elderly Americans and get their life stories. But what it amounts to is about 2,200 or so life histories of who survived enslavement.
And what did you learn from it?
Well, historians have been using these for a little while, but I think they've tended to either say, well, we believe every single thing they say, or we believe almost nothing of what they say, because many of the interviewees will say things that are contradictory. Like they'll say, well, my owner was very nice, but then they'll describe horrible things that happened on the next property over. And I think what you have to do is really engage with them as the products of people who, A, are very thoughtful about how they're telling their story, often to interviewers who they don't necessarily trust. Many of the interviewers were white, and this was the 1930 South. You can see this in the difference between the interviewers that are white, the kinds of stories they elicit and the way those stories are structured, and the interviewers who are black, who tend to get a much more sort of straightforward catalog of horrors.
So, Ed Baptist, what do you want ordinary Americans to take away from this book? The case that you're making that the life that we live today, the economy that we live in today, is based on an economy that started on slavery, and we wouldn't be here today without it.
Yeah. When the United States achieves independence, it's fairly irrelevant on the world scene, and certainly as a part of the global economy, it's pretty much small potatoes. By the time the Civil War starts in 1860, it's the second largest economy in the world, and it's the single biggest contributor to the success of the first economy in the world, which is Great Britain. Great Britain depends on its textile industry. And much of that growth, much of that transformation, much of that initial push, which we're still riding on today, you know, we've done other things since then, but I like to think of those years as those initial years of accumulation in the retirement portfolio, which are, we know, are so important if you want to build a big nest egg. So we know that much of that growth, much of that success comes from labor that was extracted from enslaved people, and even financial wealth that was based on enslaved people's bodies, which were traded and commodified. And we know that that contribution was massively important. I think the first thing we need to do is to recognize that slavery isn't something that made a few people wealthy but not other people, or made a few people in the South wealthy but not people in the North, or something that doesn't continue to have effects, not just on race relations or something like that. It clearly does that too, but on wealth and on power today. Slavery continues to have an impact on America in the most basic economic sense as well.
Ed Baptist, author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
If a new car is on your end-of-the-year shopping list, I'm sorry, because Experian Automotive says Americans are taking longer to pay off their car loans. And Washington Post personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary says stretching out those payments could backfire. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you.
First, we're seeing more and more car loans spanning 6 to 7 years. That's a lot longer than the traditional 4-year loan. Why is that happening?
Cars are more expensive and people want good cars. And so they can't afford the 4-year loan. So they're stretching it out to 5, 6, 7, and even 8 years.
Well, that seems like a good idea, I guess, because the monthly payments will get smaller the longer I have my loan. But it's not all good news, is it?
No. In fact, I tell people, if you can't buy that car and with monthly payments that you can live with for 48 months, you cannot afford that car because a number of things will be at play. First of all, most importantly, you're going to pay more interest over that time. Oftentimes, the interest rate is higher because the lender is taking on more risks because you're going to have that loan for a lot longer than what we've been typically used to, which is the 48-month loan.
So how much more interest will I be paying if I choose to pay off my loan in 6 or 7 years as opposed to 4?
You know, it depends on the interest rate and how much the car, but it could be, a couple $1,000s more.
Wow.
Depending on all those different factors. Yeah, I mean, and then also, you know, you got insurance, you know, higher insurance over that period of time. And there's so many things that could go wrong. Like, let's say you get into an accident. The longer you have a loan, the more likely you're going to be what's called upside down, meaning that you owe more on the car than it's worth. So let's say you get in an accident and the insurance company, you know, the car's totaled and the insurance company pays it off, but you still have a balance on that loan because they're only going to pay you the value of the car.
But what does that mean? So what happens if that happens to me?
So let's say you owe $10,000 on a loan, but the car is only worth $5,000. But you got to come up with $5,000 to sell the car to satisfy that loan. So you're stuck with that car. But what I found in the people that I deal with is that they will go ahead and trade in that car and tack on that difference that they owe to the new car.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And so now in the next car, they've got another long loan, 5 or 6 years, and they've got, you know, money from the past loan. So from the very time they drive over the asphalt on the lot, they're already upside down.
All right. So walk me through the process. I'm at the car lot. I have this beautiful new car that I really, really want, but I've got to decide what to do and how to negotiate for that loan. What do you recommend?
I'd like to have people walk in with a loan offer from someone, a credit union, their own bank, or someone so that they can compare it to whatever the dealer's offering. Mm. But most importantly, look, if you know you only can spend in your budget about $400 a month, don't think, oh, I'll do $400 a month for 5 or 6 years. Just 48 months, and whatever car you can buy for that, that's what you buy. So it may not be that car you want, but it is the car that you can afford.
Tough lessons from Michelle Singletary. One other question. If I can afford a car just by paying cash, should I do that?
Cash is still king, baby. I have not paid, used a loan for a car, and I don't know when. And one trick that I learned from my grandmother, Big Mama, when I did have a car loan, I would continue to make car payments to myself. So by the time I needed another car loan, now this is me, this is like 10 years later,
yeah,
I have the cash for a new or used car.
Great. Michelle Singletary writes the Color of Money column for the Washington Post with some advice about financing a new car. Michelle, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And always listen to Big Mama's advice.
TV host and model Janice Dickinson is the latest woman to step forward and accuse comedian Bill Cosby of sexual assault. In an interview with Entertainment Tonight, she said that Cosby assaulted her in 1982.
After dinner, in my room, he had given me wine and a pill, and the next morning I woke up and I wasn't wearing my pajamas, and I remember before I passed out that I had been sexually assaulted by this man.
Dickinson is just one of many women to accuse Cosby of sexual assault in incidents that they claim go back decades.
And today, Netflix decided to suspend a stand-up special with Cosby to commemorate his 77th birthday. That was scheduled to start later this month. NBC is also in development with him for a sitcom, but has made no comment on the status of that project. David Folkenflik is media correspondent for NPR. He's been following this. David, welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much, guys.
So how much pressure do media companies like NBC, Netflix face when they've got something like this on their hands?
Well, you know, they can read public opinion as well as anyone. It, in some ways, is the business they're in, is measuring the zeitgeist. And this is just a case where there's no good purpose to be served for a company like Netflix in plunging right in and saying, well, we stand by our guy. They don't know what the facts are. They weren't there. They would love for this project with Bill Cosby to be a roaring success as they measure such things. And this isn't the moment for that to be achieved. So they suspend it. You know, one suspicion is that if this goes on, they will walk away from it quietly. But, you know, it has, if for some reason Mr. Cosby turns out to be vindicated, then they can rush back and embrace him and say, we're on. Let's go forward.
So should we be waiting for NBC to come out and do something similar, say we're not going to do this project with Cosby?
I don't think you have to wait. I think you have to expect that NBC will just not pursue it with any kind of aerobic intent. You know, it's going to be very poorly placed to both cover this on its from its news division and to proceed from it on the entertainment side. This is just a hopeless place for NBC to be in at the moment.
Yeah, but we've seen this before. I mean, look at Woody Allen. You've got Roman Polanski also involved in these really difficult sexual allegations. Roman Polanski was convicted. How is this different than that?
I think it's different in part because directors and producers usually have one-off projects. You know, if you're a film producer, you can say, well, just judge the work on its own. It's a one project. And in the case of Polanski and Woody Allen, it's a very long time ago, and yet it keeps getting revived. You know, when Woody Allen was being acknowledged by the Academy and the Academy Awards, his children took to Twitter and other forums to assail him anew and accuse him again
right.
of having committed essentially child abuse. In this instance, some of these allegations are fresh, but the acknowledgement of them in a very public way really wasn't that fresh. It percolated up in the press here and there for Bill Cosby, and yet it seems to me as though it almost really took a black male comedian, Hannibal Buress's, calling Bill Cosby out, effectively accusing him of rape in a stand-up routine and saying, you know, how is it that you have the moral stature to do this, to give credence to women who had by name made these accusations over recent years.
Well, and we should say, by the way, that, you know, Bill Cosby's lawyer has said in a statement that these are discredited allegations. They're decades old. And the fact that they're being repeated does not make them true. But what about situations in the past where there's not sexual assault or abuse being alleged, but it's just somebody who has become toxic? There was Lance Armstrong, of course, who admitted to doping. And then there was Martha Stewart, who was convicted of insider trading. What about that? And when media companies have to decide what to do?
Well, and toxicity, I think, is exactly the key word there, Jeremy. You know, if you think about those instances and related instances, there's almost some sort of mathematical equation, complicated one, but with the two key variables being, you know, the investment of the institution in the brand of that person, of a Lance Armstrong, of a Martha Stewart, and the toxicity of the accusations or acts by that person. So in Lance Armstrong's case, you interestingly saw his foundation edging away from its pure identity with him. It's a foundation that does incredible stuff in cancer treatment,
right.
cancer research, and in stirring activism on that regard. But it subtly shifted its name before he acknowledged a doping, before he admitted what he had done. It shifted its identity to Live Strong. Martha Stewart, you know, stepped away from being, I believe the term of art was editorial director, but whatever it was, in being the person who day-to-day managed, you know, there's the magazine that bears her name, there's the TV show, there are all these different media brands that bore her name, and she said, you know, I won't be doing day-to-day, but they couldn't say, well, we're going to rename it, you know, Homemakers. You know, they had to figure out a way to do this, and they negotiated. Now, interestingly, in Martha Stewart's case, if you look at that, she served her time. She ultimately didn't complain terribly about it. She seemed to sort of take her lumps. And in retrospect, as you look at all kinds of offenses committed by financiers in Wall Street, people concluded that perhaps she was over-prosecuted, even if guilty, of the things for which she was convicted in terms of insider trading. She came back and, you know, it's something she acknowledges sometimes with a rueful joke, but she goes on and she flourishes and prospers.
Yeah, and David, in this case, Cosby is 77 years old. And no matter what happens with Netflix or NBC, whatever they ultimately decide to do, can Cosby recover from this?
You know, it's hard to look at that question solely in that light. You know, I mean, what we really have to kind of think through is what kind of reckoning is there going to be? And to what degree is there going to be an authoritative answer to the question that did this such an epical figure, such an important guy for you know, in terms of the representation of particularly African Americans in popular culture and television, what is he going to have to acknowledge, or is he somehow going to be able to be vindicated? Will there be some final word on this?
Well, it's just shocking to find out about it.
It's shocking, it's incongruous, and it's hard to reconcile, which is, I think, why the press had trouble dealing with this story. I think, to be fair to journalists, you know, this story was raised periodically. Charges were ventilated. Women by name at times came forward, made these allegations. But because there's no law enforcement inquiry on this, it's hard for journalists to point to something seemingly authoritative and said, this occurred. That said, a lot of journalists over the years who have interviewed him prior, particularly the Scott Simons interview with him not so many days ago, you know, they were wary of raising this issue, even though it seems to me very hard to look at this guy and understand him in full without the charges. And one last thing, you know, a biography, a best-selling biography by the very respected journalist Mark Whitaker, a former top executive at CNN, NBC, and at Newsweek magazine, didn't mention these allegations. I don't know how you do a 360 evaluation of a figure like this and his full life without somehow incorporating and trying to weave it in and come to terms with it.
All right, NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik on this story, which continues to develop around Bill Cosby. Thanks so much, David.
You bet.
And I said Martha Stewart was convicted of insider trading. She was actually found guilty of conspiracy, making false statements, and obstruction of justice, and she served time. Well, we took a week off, but we are back now with another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Ann Litt, DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica, California, is back with us again. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Jeremy. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. And let's get right to the music. You wanted us to hear from the Irish singer-songwriter Damian Rice, who is out with his first solo album in 8 years. Here he is with I Don't Want to Change You.
Wherever you are, we know that I adore you. No matter how far, well, I can go before you. And if ever you need someone, well, not that you need helping.
Okay, first of all, I like that sound a lot. And second of all, I want to just say, for people who may remember, Damian Rice had a very successful album in 2002. His next album did not go over as well. He told the LA Times, I basically crashed and burned at the end of the last tour. Now he's back. What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's beautiful. I think it's sweet and satisfying. And I think the thing I love about this song in particular is that the words are absolutely beautifully simple, but the emotion and the passion is what I heard in Damian Rice's debut album. And he's back with that, you know, self-effacing as always, but with that inner core of just heart and passion.
Wherever you go, I can always follow. slow. If it's a lot to swallow.
And a really nice, smooth sound there as well.
Beautiful. The orchestration is lovely. It doesn't overpower what he's doing, the poetry he's bringing with the lyrics. It just complements it oh so sweetly.
All right, well, now to the Brooklyn indie rock group TV on the Radio. They're releasing their fifth album this week. You wanted us to hear something from that. Here is Careful You.
Oui, je t'aime, oui, je t'aime. À demain, à la prochaine. Best to say goodbye, but I can't seem to move away. Not to say that you shouldn't share the blame. There is a softness to your touch, there is a wonder to your way. No, no. How I feel, what's the deal? Is it real? When's it gonna go down?
Another great but very different sound there, Anne. And I understand this is the first album that they have made since the death of one of their members, bassist Gerard Smith, who died of lung cancer in 2011. What do you hear in this album?
Well, I think what I hear is emotion, similar to Damien Rice, but it presented in a completely different way. This is raw. They came to Los Angeles. In fact, a couple of the members of the band now live in Los Angeles. They recorded it here. And the thing about TV on the Radio and the way their albums emerge is that they go their separate ways after a project, and you never know when you'll hear from them again. So every TV on the Radio album, to me, is a gift. And in this album in particular, and referencing the death of their close band member, I just hear raw emotion, especially in this song.
You know, I recognized this song as soon as I heard it, and I don't know whether that's because I've heard it just listening to the KCRW music app, which I do very frequently.
Well, I have to say, this has been a favorite among all of our DJs, and I do think it strikes a chord. The song starts out saying, oui, je t'aime, à demain, à la prochaine. I know it's best to say goodbye, but I can't seem to move away. And I think that pretty much encapsulates the spirit of the entire album.
Well, while you're speaking French, let's move along to a group called Let's. This is Charles de Gaulle.
I'd like to thank Charles de Gaulle. Thank the police and all. A quarantine that changed my world. When our life became a swirl, we got some fears we need to break. And I know that you're afraid. Perhaps you're young and I am old. I'll still love you when I'm bones. I'll still love you when I'm bones.
Tell us about Let's.
Well, Let's is the project of Christian Let's. He plays guitar and sings in Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros. And this is his first solo release. And collaborating on the release, he got together with Marcus Mumford of Mumford & Sons. The two bands toured together last year. And he played Marcus Mumford some of his demos, and he loved them. And so members of Mumford & Sons and Edward Sharp are playing on Let's' debut album.
And Marcus Mumford, by the way, is part of the new group, the New Basement Tapes, right?
Exactly. And we're going to play a song called Kansas City.
Okay, let's listen to that.
And you tell me a thousand things a day, then sleep somewhere else at night, going back to Kansas City. And I love you, dear, but just how long can I keep singing the same? And I love you, dear, but just how long can I keep singing the same old song? I'm going back to Kansas City.
Okay. Okay, I mentioned Marcus Mumford, but there are a lot of other people in this group that many of our listeners may know very well.
Absolutely. T-Bone Burnett got a call from Bob Dylan's publisher about a year or so ago saying, you know, we just found an old box of Bob Dylan lyrics from back in the basement tape sessions, and would you like to do something with them? And T-Bone said, yes. Hmm. And so he assembled Elvis Costello, Marcus Mumford, Jim James, who you may know from My Morning Jacket, Rhiannon Giddens, who's part of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and Taylor Goldsmith, who is in the band Dawes. And these five musicians, along with T-Bone, went into Capitol Studios earlier this year for 2 weeks and just did a freewheeling session where they wrote music to go with these old Bob Dylan lyrics.
And what do you like about their sound?
What I love about their sound is those five musicians and T-Bone, the producer, love each other, support each other, and the collaboration that went on to create this album comes through. It is dripping off every song on this album. And one of the reasons I wanted to play Kansas City for you is that there's a documentary that's debuting on Showtime this coming Friday night, the 21st, about the making of the new Basement Tapes album called Lost on the River. And this song in particular, Kansas City, has a real story, a through line in the documentary, really about the difficulty, the challenges of songwriting, and then the joy when it comes out beautifully on the other side.
Ann Litt, DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
You don't care if I'm asleep or I'm awake.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now.
And you know, Jeremy, I have downloaded that Damien Rice song that we heard at the very beginning. I listened to it over and over and over again.
I think that's my favorite one. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.